Pull up a chair. I want you to stand where I stood a few years back, on the polished concrete floor of the big museum out in Dayton, Ohio. The National Museum of the United States Air Force. Four hangars, acres of airplanes, quiet as a church. And there she was, a B-17F Flying Fortress. Olive drab up top, gray on the belly, nose art of a long-legged girl in a blue swimsuit. The name painted right there on the aluminum skin. Memphis Belle. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger and this is The Hangar, the show where we sit with the old airplanes and let them tell us what they saw. Today we're going to talk about the most famous bomber in American history. Not because she dropped the most bombs, not because she was the fastest or the toughest, but because she came home 25 times, and then she almost didn't survive peacetime at all. Before we get into it, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And boy, does the airplane we're talking about today have a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene for you. It's the spring of 1943. England, a place called Bassingbourne, an airfield northeast of London, home to the 91st Bomb Group. The 8th Air Force is trying to do something that had never been done. Daylight precision bombing, flying into occupied Europe in broad daylight, in tight formation, without fighter escort that could go the whole way. And the loss rates were staggering. Understand what that meant for a young man in 1943. The tour of duty was 25 missions. Fly 25 and you go home. Simple math. Except the odds said you would not live to see it. In those early days, the statistics were brutal enough that finishing a full tour was less likely than not finishing one. The men knew it. They did the arithmetic in their bunks at night. Into that walked a crew and an airplane. The airplane was a Boeing B-17F, serial number 41-24485, built in Long Beach, California, just one of thousands. Nothing special coming off the line. The pilot was a young man from Asheville, North Carolina, named Robert Morgan, and Morgan had a sweetheart back in Memphis, Tennessee. A young woman named Margaret Polk. He named the airplane after her. Well, sort of. The story goes the whole crew had been trying to settle on a name, and Morgan had seen a pin-up illustration in a magazine, a George Petty girl, and it clicked. His girl, Memphis, the Memphis Belle. They had the artwork painted on the nose. That leggy girl in the swimsuit, one on each side of the fuselage, red on the left, blue on the right. And then they went to war. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Let me put you inside that airplane, because this is the part the picture on the museum floor cannot tell you. A B-17 at altitude was one of the most miserable places a human being could go and still be technically alive. They flew at 25,000 feet, sometimes higher. There was no pressurization, there was no heat to speak of, the temperature at that altitude ran to 50-60 below zero. The men wore electrically heated suits that failed constantly, and when they failed, frostbite came for your fingers, your toes, your face. The waist gunners stood at open windows open, the wind screaming through at better than 150 miles an hour. You breathed through an oxygen mask, and the moisture from your breath would freeze inside it, and you'd have to squeeze the ice out or you'd suffocate on your own frozen breath. The noise, four Wright Cyclone engines, 1,200 horsepower apiece, unmuffled, for hours. Men came home from the war, with their hearing gone. You didn't talk in a fortress, you couldn't. You shouted into the interphone, or you used your hands. And the smell, cordite from the 50 caliber guns, hot oil, hydraulic fluid, exhaust. And under all of it, the raw high-octane bite of Avgas. Now add the enemy.
Flak first. German anti-aircraft guns throwing up shells timed to burst at your altitude. You'd fly into a sky that turned black with it, ugly little clouds blossoming all around you, and each one was steel fragments looking for aluminum and flesh, and you could not turn, you could not jink. On the bomb run, you flew straight and level and let it come, because if you flinched, you missed the target and the whole horrible trip was for nothing. Then the fighters, Messerschmitts and Focke-Wulfs, coming head-on through the formation, closing at combined speeds you could barely track, the gunners hammering away. Brass shell casings piling up on the floor, rolling around your feet, ankle deep. That was a mission. That was one. The Memphis Belle and her crew did that 25 times. Let me be honest with you about something, because this show is built on getting the history right, and the sources have sorted this out over the years. The legend says, the Memphis Belle was the first 8th Air Force bomber to complete 25 missions. The truth is a little more tangled. There were other airplanes and crews right in the same race, one called Hell's Angels among them, that reached the number around the same time or even a hair earlier,
depending on how you count crew versus airframe. But here's what matters. The Memphis Belle finished 25 with Morgan and his crew in the spring of 1943, and she was the one the Army chose to make famous. Why? Because of a man with a movie camera.
There was a Hollywood director in uniform named William Wyler, a serious filmmaker. He would go on after the war to make some of the great pictures. And in 1943, the Army Air Forces wanted a documentary, real combat, real color film, something to show the folks back home what their sons were doing over Europe, and frankly, something to help sell the whole costly idea of daylight bombing. Wyler and his cameramen actually flew missions, in the airplanes, hanging out of a bomber over occupied France with a camera instead of a gun. One of his cameramen was killed doing exactly that on another aircraft. This was not staged. Men died making this film. Wyler shot footage on several different fortresses, but he built his story around one airplane with a good name and a photogenic crew and a finish line in sight. The Memphis Belle. In 1944, the film came out, in color, and it was called simply The Memphis Belle, a story of a flying fortress. And America fell in love. The airplane and her crew were pulled off combat and sent home on a war bond tour. 30-some cities. Morgan flying the Belle low over grandstands full of people, selling war bonds, shaking hands, keeping the whole enormous machine of the war effort funded. She'd done her job in the air. Now she did her job on the ground. Let me pour a little more coffee, because now comes the part that ought to make every one of us who loves old airplanes sit up. After the war, what do you do with a used bomber? You had thousands of them. Tens of thousands of American warplanes, suddenly surplus, suddenly worth more as aluminum than as airplanes, out in the desert at places like Kingman, Arizona, they lined the fortresses and the liberators up wingtip to wingtip by the mile and fed them into the smelters, melted them into ingots. A brand new four-engine bomber that cost a fortune and cost lives turned into pots and pans. The Memphis Belle was headed for exactly that fate. She was flown out to the reclamation field, the scrap line, the end. And a man from Memphis, Tennessee heard about it. The mayor of Memphis, a fellow named Walter Chandler, could not stand the idea. This was their airplane, the Belle, named for a Memphis girl, and the city bought her, paid a token price, something like the scrap value, and brought her home to Tennessee to save her. Good intentions. Now here's the hard part. Saving an airplane and caring for an airplane are two very different things. And for decades, the Memphis Belle was saved but not cared for. She sat outdoors, she sat on a pedestal, she sat under a flimsy open pavilion, she sat by the National Guard Armory, she moved around the city over the years, and she sat outside in the Tennessee weather through all of it. Rain, sun, humidity, that peels the paint off anything. And people came for her, not enemies this time. Souvenir hunters, vandals, folks who'd climb up inside and take a piece, instruments walked off the panel. Guns disappeared. Someone would break a window, birds got in, water pooled in the belly and the corrosion crept through the airframe that Flak had never managed to bring down. The airplane that survived the Luftwaffe was being slowly killed by neglect and by souvenir knives. There were good people in Memphis who fought for her, who formed groups and raised money and did what they could. But a bare metal bomber sitting outdoors is fighting a war it cannot win. The elements never miss and they never go home. And eventually the hard truth became clear. If the Memphis Belle was going to survive for the next 100 years, she needed to go somewhere with a roof, a climate-controlled building, and a full-time staff of people whose whole job is keeping old airplanes alive. She needed to go to Dayton. So in 2005, after a good deal of heartache and argument, and there was heartache, because Memphis loved that airplane, she was disassembled and trucked north to the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Ohio, to the restoration hangar.
Now let me tell you what those restoration folks do, because this is where I get genuinely moved, and I've been around airplanes my whole life. The restoration took 13 years. 13 years, think about that. She flew 25 combat missions in a matter of months, and it took the museum 13 years to undo the damage of decades sitting in the weather and bring her back to exactly what she looked like on a mission in the summer of 1943. These are craftsmen. They found period-correct parts, tracked down the right instruments, the right radios, the right guns. Where a piece was too far gone or simply gone, they fabricated it to original spec. They researched the exact shade of the paint. They put back the nose art, both girls red and blue, done right.
They didn't make her shiny. That's the thing people get wrong about the best restorations. They didn't make her a jewelry store showpiece. They made her look like she looked on the day she came back from her 25th mission, combat weathered, honest. A working airplane that did a terrible job and did it well. And on May 17, 2018, 75 years to the day after that 25th mission,
They rolled her out onto the museum floor and opened her to the public where she sits today, indoors, climate-controlled, watched over, safe. I stood in front of her like I told you at the top, and I'll tell you what got me. It wasn't the size, though. A fortress is bigger than folks expect. It wasn't the guns or the nose art. It was standing there thinking about 10 young men, average age somewhere around their early 20s, kids really, climbing into that freezing, screaming, unpressurized aluminum tube 25 separate times, knowing the numbers, knowing what the odds said, and going anyway, and then thinking about how close we came as a country to melting the evidence of what they did into scrap ingots, and how close we came after that to letting her rot in the rain. She's the last of her kind that people know by name. There are other fortresses in the world, a handful still flying, a few more in museums, but there's one Memphis Belle, and she's a monument now, not just to a crew and an airplane, but to the whole idea that some things are worth saving even when it's hard, even when it's expensive, even when it would be easier to look away. Robert Morgan, the pilot, he lived a long life. He flew again in the Pacific later in the war in B-29s. He was there in Dayton in his later years to see the restoration underway before he passed. And Margaret Polk, the Memphis Belle herself, the girl the airplane was named for, she and Morgan didn't end up together. Life goes the way it goes. But the name stuck to that airplane forever. Her name is going to be on the side of a flying fortress in a museum in Ohio for as long as America has museums. That's not a bad kind of immortality.
If you ever find yourself anywhere near Dayton, Ohio, do yourself a favor. The National Museum of the United States Air Force is free to get in, and it is one of the great aviation museums on this earth. Go find her. Stand where I stood. Take your time. My thanks today to the National Museum of the United States Air Force for the history and the record of that 13-year restoration, to the surviving accounts left behind by Robert Morgan and his crew, and to William Wyler, whose wartime film is the reason we can still watch that airplane fly. You can find more at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Next time somebody tells you an old airplane is just aluminum, you tell them about the Belle. Keep them flying.